All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. It's Fridays with Sandy. Sandy, I just want to put a hold on all the other things that I had lined up to talk about and have a dialogue and a conversation with you with your vast knowledge on how things work in this country. Because, you know, the American people, we don't know. We don't have any idea. So we look at, like, the trains, and we think that the people, Northern or whatever the name of the train company is, owns all of the, owns all of the cars.
Train cars, yeah.
And who owns the tracks? The government?
The tracks?
Yeah.
No, the tracks are, the roadbeds and tracks, the roadbed rights are probably under easements, although they might have, the right-of-ways might be owned by the railroads. I think that the rights of way were acquired by the railroads, many of them under the Homestead Act, where they got broad swaths of land. I know Union Pacific Railroad, for instance, owned a broad swath of right of way going west, and they had lots of oil and gas on it. So Union Pacific became an owner of a great deal of oil and gas.
So what I'm trying to get to is, off the air, we were talking about the air. The planes and who owns the planes. Yeah. We think that the planes are all owned by a specific company.
Yeah, what happened was when the railroads got started, it was going to take a lot of capital, a lot of money at the level of the railroad to actually buy up all the train cars and engines and everything they would need to use. And so it was going to be much easier for them to lease them from somebody who might own them. And what happened was that the financial community figured out a way to set up what was called rolling stock equipment trusts. And in the beginning, almost every car and every locomotive was owned by a consortium of people, a small group of investors, who would own the car, get the depreciation rights for it, which would give them this magic tax shelter. It was, you know, so that they could avoid paying taxes because they owned this asset that was depreciated faster. And so that's the way many train cars were owned. And when the airline industry got started, the same thing started happening with airplanes. So one of the earliest things I did in my law career was to work on equipment trust leasing for some airplanes. And so now in today's world, many train cars are owned in this independent way and then leased by the railroad. The railroad would, however, be responsible for the maintenance on these cars while they lease them. And the same is true of the airplanes. A significant percentage of planes are not owned by the airline and themselves, but they're owned by these independent entities that have trust leasing going on, and then they lease the plane to the airline. But the airline is responsible for maintenance on it during its period of the lease. So, from the public standpoint, it doesn't much matter because the liability belongs to the person operating it with respect to train crashes and plane crashes.
So the reason I was asking, Sandy, is, again, we now our attention is focused on these trains that almost now daily there's one that's occurring where trains are coming off their tracks, and so I don't know how many different railroad companies there still are, but apparently there's still quite a few. I back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that was clearly something that, you know, we had everywhere, because manufacturing was still, you know, going on here, and so the trains were moving all of that stuff. But I for the life of me, Sandy, I don't get, and I think American people don't get, how complex all of these things are in our government and businesses and all of those things. We don't see the inner workings of those things but they're pretty involved.
Well, they are pretty involved, and you know, the market economy is the entity that solves the problems of, for instance, over the last 40 years, our economy has evolved with respect to long haul things still moved by trains. Okay, if you have to move move something from Los Angeles to Chicago or New York, the cheapest way for most things to move is by train. It's not the fastest, but it's the cheapest. But then when you have to get it from wherever it unloads in Chicago to the last mile, there used to be lots of short-haul train arrangements. So, in fact, I'm sure that when you worked at A. O. Smith, there was a train siding, and there would be train cars at A. O. Smith that were getting loaded with frames
right. So
they could get hooked up to a freight train and move on. And that would be a short-haul train system that would move it from that in that short distance over to the long haul provider. Now the last mile is much more done by trucks, and the whole container industry has changed the world quite a bit. So most of the freight trains you see are loaded with containers, and many of those containers came off of container ships
right. That
came from China, get on a long haul, then they get put on a truck for the last portion of their haul. So you know, this thing has all evolved, but still, you know, some of the old ways of financing things has gone on, and it was sort of a remarkable, flexible approach that Wall Street provided that allowed railroads and airlines to build up very rapidly because of the ability to access this capital in all these small increments to get all the trains, all the train cars, all the planes.
So then the question becomes, Sandy, because the bottom line to all of it is how this can be done economically and profitably, right? So what I'm saying is, now you got railroad cars with 200 cars. And it used to be 200 cars on one engine, on one track. Certainly save somebody some money somewhere along the line, but it endangers a lot of different things, a lot of different people. And somebody said, okay, we're going to do that. Because that wasn't always the way it was. And now all of a sudden, these companies have been able to create this where they can talk with Congress people and they change the rules.
Well, interesting.
And the safety, I remember... Sandy, I remember when, and as you well remember, when they wouldn't allow those chemicals on trains.
Well, you know, it's interesting because trains used to be relatively unregulated, but they were one of the first things to get regulated. Part of the regulation was to regulate the prices they were charging because there was the problem of rebates and monopolies and how they were exploiting trains through, you know, Rockefeller and oil and the rest of it. But then in the 20s and 30s, safety on trains became a big issue, and so railroad safety began to be regulated, and part of the New Deal involved a great deal of safety regulation, including with respect to trains. Safety for the people working on the trains, but also safety for the general public that might be affected by train accidents. And so, again, this is a problem that I would ultimately lay at the feet of K Street and the ability of lobbyists to erode the ability of government to deliver to us what essentially our market economy needs, which is effective regulation to make sure that our market economy doesn't fail. You know, that railroad that had that accident in the Norfolk Railroad that had the accident in Palestine is going to have a lot of financial trouble now. They would have been far better off if they didn't have that accident. And so they could have actually sort of appreciated the government intervening and imposing on them what seemed like some unpleasant and intrusive regulations to keep them, to save them from themselves. Much the way Boeing would have been far better off if they had been well regulated with respect to the Dreamliner, so that they hadn't come out with a Dreamliner that failed and put Boeing at the precipice of financial distress.
So Sandy, when we talk about things that we take for granted in this country, you know, the different industries like people who get on buses that take you, Badger, Greyhound buses, and all these other kinds of transportation that we have available. We don't give it a second thought. We just think that these things, they're there.
Mm-hmm.
But the regulations and all the things that go on behind the scenes, because I have to get back to, again, the train part of it, Sandy. I don't know, maybe it was in the 80s when they decided to put these dangerous chemicals on the tracks. They used to not allow it. And I remember when they passed the law, I can't tell you when, to allow that to travel throughout neighborhoods. There was a time when they didn't allow that in this country because of what happened in Palestine. But they were able to point out and say, well, you know, if you look at all the different trains that go through, this is still a small percentage, very small percentage of accidents, but all it takes is one, right?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, adequate regulation is, you know, the people who are regulated find it to be inconvenient and potentially seemingly more expensive. But adequate regulation of, for instance, railroad safety or airline safety is actually there for the benefit of the railroads and the airlines as well, because they need to be saved to some extent from themselves. They need someone looking over their shoulder to make sure they don't make mistakes, which would be catastrophic to them. You know, it's the black swan.
So we got to go to a break, Sandy, but when we come back, then I want you to explain to the listening audience why we've got the people who continue to fight the regulations, when we sometimes know the regulations are necessary to protect us. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. I mean,
has anybody here seen my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone? Oh, he freed a lot of people, but it seems a good die young, yeah. I just looked around and he was gone. Has anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone?
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, before we went to break, I was asking you about regulations. And we live in a society where there are people in corporations and who bemoan regulations and too much regulations, and you often hear that, especially people on the right who say there's too many regulations. I recall going back to Ronald Reagan. He was always saying we're holding back businesses, and they can't move forward because they're weighted down with regulations. You worked in sectors, Sandy, where, you know, there's got to be a balance, right?
Actually, my legal specialty ended up being essentially regulatory law. And I worked with companies who probably were uncomfortable by, would have preferred not to be regulated. Everyone would prefer not to be regulated. Everyone believes that if left to their own devices, they would do just fine and everything would be optimized. But the fact is that the American economy, in many respects, is respected across the world because of the nature of the way it's regulated. So that, I've said this before, but our financial industry is the gold standard in the world, primarily because of the way it's regulated by the SEC, and primarily because how disciplined our accounting industry was, and maybe it deteriorated some leading up into the Enron problem, but the financial regulation in this country makes our financial industry trustworthy. The regulation by the Food and Drug Administration is something that made our food and drugs more trustworthy.
But not anymore.
Well, not so much anymore, because right. We're eroding the effectiveness of our regulation. But we should understand that regulation, in many respects, provides what we used to call the good housekeeping stamp of approval for the rest of the world to trust. And so the regulation for safety in airline manufacturing was there, yes, to protect the public, but it could and would protect Boeing from making terrible mistakes by having someone looking over their shoulder. And if they had had effective regulation looking over their shoulder when they were producing the Dreamliner, they would not have suffered the huge financial problems they suffered by having to defer the manufacture and sale of that Dreamliner for as many years as they did to bring it up into safety standards. And that was a failure of regulation, quite frankly. The FAA had ceded back to Boeing the opportunity to give the fox the opportunity to watch the chicken coop and to regulate itself. So many regulations are there, yes, to protect the public, but they also are good for the companies being regulated because it provides a good housekeeping stamp of approval to what they do. Now, some of the regulations might not do that to the public, but for instance, OSHA regulation, a company might find it hard to find employees in today's world if they didn't provide a safe workplace, right? So OSHA regulations might help a company find its employees as well as protecting the employee's safety. And so, you know, the deregulation movement that started in the 80s was not about the kind of safety regulations we're talking about. The deregulation of the price of gas and the deregulation of the price of airline tickets was far different than the kind of oversight regulation that is now being essentially attacked by those being regulated. And they're doing it, and they're going to cut off their nose to spite their face. They're going to choke the golden goose. By, for instance, this railroad, Norfolk, that suffered this huge problem, I guarantee you is going to suffer huge financial consequences as the result of it. And so regulation is...
As well they should.
As well they should. And the fact is that if there had been adequate regulation, they might have had to inspect these vehicles more often, or they might have been inspected more often. There might not have been the bearing failure that occurred in the axle. You know, it doesn't take a big problem apparently to cause a big problem.
So now everybody in railroad travel is going to have to deal with that because they're all going to be made now.
Yes.
This is going to become something that is going to have to happen now.
Yeah, the horse left the barn on the one accident, but now it's going to be imposed on everyone to look for this. And
As well it should be,
but it'll be, because it'll all happen at once, it'll be a big expensive problem. If it had been like ongoing, this is the difference between deferred maintenance that then becomes expensive when you finally do it, when you should have been doing it all along. Well, if they had been doing the regulation all along, they wouldn't end up with a burst of a problem that now is exposing everyone. So
and may take them to bankruptcy.
Right. So I mean, I'm just saying, the people who are fighting regulation don't really, maybe they're fighting
hold the thought.
Is in their own interest.
Got to go to a break. Bill from McCunnum Mark, hang on. We'll be right back.
Oh, I just looked around.
welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Let's go to Bill. Hey, from McCullum Hall. Good morning, Bill. How you doing? Thank you very much for holding. You say what?
Thanks, Sandy, for the way he explained about regulations. Here's something, though, your listeners need to hear. Regulations are part of that's government. That's something to be feared of. That's going to destroy you. They're coming to get you. And that's our big fox, or as I call it, the stupid stick nation. They believe that by all this, look at the misinformation of COVID and what that cost it, and they didn't want any regulations on COVID. They didn't want to say you have to get a shot, you have to wear a mask. That cost hundreds of thousands of lives. And then move forward with all their other misinformation, where if government had been able to do its job, we would have averted a major disaster. The reason they promote it is their Superfund people don't want regulations. If I ran a mega corporation, no, I don't want to put electric brakes on all my train cars to stop them, because it just costs too much money. I'll take the chance that they derail. I'll take that chance. Had they had that, all of this would be avoided. And I don't know if it's divine intervention or what, but all of a sudden that particular railroad is having accidents on a regular basis. And as you said, Earl, they're going to face bankruptcy. So how do we deal with this? We have to say, teach people the integrity of the product is there because of the regulations. If you want integrity, have regulations. If you don't want integrity and just roll the dice and just go for the money, it'll burn you in the long run.
Well,
always burn you.
Well, you know, Bill, they'll point to regulations costing more money and for the company and for the corporations. And I don't know, Sandy, you said you dealt with a lot of that. Is that short-sighted on
Some yeah, of course it is. And corporations need – that's the problem with the way – when Wall Street was forced to look at quarterly earnings, they began to make decisions that were not as totally rational as they should have been about the undertaking of risks. And if you're an executive and your stock grant is going to take effect in 2 years – and it's going to be a lot of money for you, you're going to start looking at only 2 years out and the risks that are incurred during the 2 years and not what's exposed in the long run, okay? So, you know, you need to have rational decision-making by corporations, and the corporations might have time horizons that are different than the public's with respect to this. And what Bill said is absolutely right. The integrity of products matters. I mentioned off the air how it was that PG&E, this electric utility in California, should have been maintaining their rights of way for their transmission lines to make sure that trees wouldn't impinge on it and start fires. They didn't do it over the years. They began to start fires. The brush fires in California cost PG&E ultimately billions of dollars in a bankruptcy. If they had been maintaining those rights of way and they had not been able to be proven to have been negligent in the way they maintained their system, they wouldn't have had that liability. And, you know, so regulation is important to the regulated company as well as it is to the public. And the time horizon for corporations might not be the same. So that whereas a corporation thinks they can take care of it themselves, they're not going to take care of it in the manner that the long-term interest of that corporation might want it taken care of.
You know, Sandy, you always say something that then leads me to the next question. But you were talking about when corporations made the decision to look at these things quarterly. I remember as a young guy working at A. O. Smith before they started looking at things quarterly, long-term profit in this country. And certainly they weren't making anywhere near as much as when they were looking at these short-term profitability. It changed the whole way that I think manufacturing was doing business in this country. It changed everything. When I was a young man working at A. O. Smith Company, the company would take contracts knowing long term they would be profitable. But we'll take this short term, knowing we may lose some money short term, but we're in it for the long haul. I remember when the companies changed, when that way of thinking changed, Sandy, on the corporate level, what brought that about?
Well, I've talked about it early in the early in my appearances on here, but there was this evolution from where management was running the company with little oversight from the shareholders, and then we went through the period of conglomerates where companies began to buy up other companies unrelated to the industry. A. O. Smith got into that.
Right.
They had a bunch of different things.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, train frames.
Yeah, they were buying everything.
Frames for cars and water heaters,
right,
and you name it. And so when they got into that business, then they were owning a variety of companies, and they had to kind of pit investment opportunities that they had at the corporate level between the various companies they owned. So they began to measure things more closely then. Then they began to have the leverage buyout arrangement where people would buy a company and impose a lot of debt on it, and then essentially buy the company with the debt that they were going to put on the company. It was bootstrap acquisitions, they were called initially, where you would bootstrap. You didn't have to have much money going in. You'd simply buy the company, borrow a bunch of money in the company, pay it back to yourself, and you didn't spend much for the company.
Yeah, and then shut down the company.
But as soon as you have a lot of debt on a company, now you're worried about paying the interest every month. You begin to worry about quarterly earnings because you've put risk on the company short-term financial. So you've changed the financial outlook to a much more short-term outlook. And that's what ultimately happened in the American economy. We have more leverage in companies. Our companies are taking more financial risk. They have to look in the short term to make sure they make it through. Then we put a bunch of compensation incentives out for management that were stock grants and more importantly, stock options, which would be exercised within a year or two, so that management of companies was going to make a lot of money based on how well the company did over the next year or two or three. So what's their time horizon? It's no longer the long term. It's just the next year, two or three, when they can make a ton of money. And, you know, you'd say, well, and they would deny that they were operating that way, but human nature follows incentives. And so our economy got much more moved in that direction. And really, regulation will help those companies think in a longer term and will help them save themselves from the risks that their management will otherwise be willing to take in order to make a ton of money.
You know, Sandy, I'm just a bump on a log, man. And I remember those things and the damage that it did, because a lot of those acquisitions, they wound up shutting down the companies once they bought them.
Sure.
And a lot of those companies employed generational families. And so I saw all of that. I didn't understand it because the complexities of what was actually taking place, but that's kind of what happened. We haven't been able to get beyond that short-term quarterly. Are we ever going to get past that quarterly profit? Has it been, in your mind, it's been good for corporations. Has it been good for the American people?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it changed the atmosphere. It probably made for a more go-go financial market. It made for faster growth in businesses. It also created a faster half-life for businesses. You know, in today's world with technologies coming and going, there maybe isn't a long term for many companies unless they think about evolving what they do into the next thing. You know, if you made buggies, you better think about making automobiles pretty quickly, because otherwise you're out of business. And so, you know, I think one thing that is changing a little bit is what happened to the labor force in the pandemic, which is causing people to want to hold on to workers. Holding on to workers forces them to think a little longer term about profits, because holding on to workers will cause them to incur some costs in the near term that they could have avoided with layoffs. But they have to think now, wait a minute. If I save money this quarter, I might give up a bunch of money two quarters from now because I won't have the workers I need, because I already found out that happened during the pandemic. When the pandemic ended, I didn't have the workers. So we might be swinging in the direction of getting a little bit better longer-term thinking. And so, you know, there's a bunch of competing forces in the economy. Private equity is not a long-term investor. And so that's move towards private equity investment has moved us towards shorter time horizons. But we got into this about regulation. All of these forces that create shorter time horizons make more important that we have adequate government regulation in the areas that where there needs to be regulation, public safety, product quality. These things need to be protected for the benefit of the companies themselves as well as the public.
You know, Sandy. And
let me give one anecdote. I had some tree trimming done on my yard. A Hoppy Tree Service came, and the nice guy I was talking to was cutting, and he had a very nifty safety helmet on that had a radio in it and everything. I began to talk to him about it. It was from Finland. And I said, "You guys buy your equipment from Finland?" He said, "Yeah. The European Union has far better regulations, and we have a far greater confidence in the quality of the stuff we buy for lumbering if we buy it from the European Union companies." Isn't that interesting? Because their regulation was helping the sales of the stuff that was made by Husqvarna and the various people in Europe, because they knew regulation over there was better than the regulation here.
You know, Sandy, all I know is that, you know, you look at all the different things that we as citizens and use, from soap to toothpaste to mouthwash. I don't care what it is. Right now, eye drops. There's all sorts of things going on with eye drops.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't know if you were aware.
Yeah, I saw blindness being caused by eye drops.
Yeah, So we don't know, man. We have to trust as the American people. We trust it when we go into a Walmart, as I was in yesterday, and purchase something. We trust that what's on the shelves are going to have been already regulated and are going to be good for us, right? Is it safe to say that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, you understand that the company that makes eye drops that cause people to be blind will probably have a great deal of financial problems as well. So there's two travesties involved. The people who are affected negatively by these eye drops and the company that makes them. And just so long as K Street doesn't get to the point of being able to insulate the manufacturers from liability, you know, because if we insulate the manufacturers from liability, then all we would have to save us would be regulation. And if the K Street can keep them from being regulated and insulate them from liability, Katie bar the door as far as the public is concerned.
So let's talk about K Street and who would be able to insulate them from liability that they created. They created this. They caused the harm to somebody. And the fact that they can then get away and be protected is where all of this lies.
Well, you understand. There's a war against trial lawyers, the Trial Lawyer Association, meaning plaintiff's lawyers, the people who bring lawsuits on the behalf of those that are injured.
Right.
But K Street is also actively involved with trying to enact laws that will insulate businesses from class action liability for the mistakes they might make. You know, it's all designed to try and keep businesses from being put out of business by essentially their own negligence. And so, you know, regulation is there to save us. It's also there to save the companies. And the companies need to be somewhat at risk, okay, because regulation can't be perfect.
So here's what I say to that, Sandy. If we do something to harm someone else, then we as citizens face the being sued and losing whatever it is we have.
Yep.
Shouldn't companies also face that same reality?
Sure. K Street will say, but what about all those poor employees of that company? Should they be put out of work because of the stupidity of a couple of guys in the engineering office? I can weave the case real fast.
Phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Fridays and Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, you always say, Sandy, it's complex. And, man, I would just think, man, that for the life of me, you know, baby formula. You would just think anybody who would be producing baby formula would make sure that whatever it is they were putting in baby formula would cause no problem. If I'm a manufacturer of baby formula, I'm going to say, hey, man, we got to make sure that there's nothing that's going to be in here that's going to harm babies.
Well, remember when Ford Pinto put their gas tanks in a place where they'd explode?
Right, right.
You know, you manufacturers, they don't intend to have these problems, but adequate regulation and you know, the Pinto thing was what basically started a great deal of oversight over automobile manufacturing and recalls and getting it right. And the automobile dealers, you know, manufacturers now are fairly enthusiastic about participating in recalls, because you know what happens? You bring your car in for a recall, and then it needs other service work, and the dealer is real happy to do the whole thing. And so, you know, all of this, you know, that's the thing that gets me about the political fight against regulation, because I'm telling you, they don't even understand. They're cutting off their nose to spite their face. It's such a short-term outlook that it's foolish, and yet there's a great deal of enthusiasm about it in terms of talking about how government's the problem, it's getting in the way. You know, some of it is the public's interest. Environmental regulation, yes, it's all inconvenient to business, right? And yet, however, the public needs to have that regulation. Our rivers...
You just took the words out of my mouth.
Used to be sewers.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. The Milwaukee River, the tanneries that were downtown, the breweries, all of those things that just ran all of that sludge into the rivers because there were no regulations.
Right. And, you know, the value of the real estate along that river is now enormous, right? And it was all that stuff was valueless when that thing was a sewer. So even from the standpoint of financial value to the community at large, the improvement of that river is an important asset. It wasn't important to maybe U.S. Leather, the company that was going to have to pay for the problems they created. And maybe they were innocently created because that was the way everyone did business in 1925. But regardless, regulation in almost every respect is a positive and has been a positive for business generally and has been a positive for the economy.
But again, you know, I just for the life of me do not and never will fathom it. And maybe it's because, again, I've never been on the other side of it. I've never been on the side from the people on the business side defending it. I can only see it from the perspective of a citizen who's being impacted and affected by a product that they created, that they sell to us, that then does harm to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way I can see that. And that they should be charged for whatever it is that they've done with their whatever it is they created and produced, and it shouldn't be, well, it's going to put the business out of business because you've harmed. And I don't know if it's, Sandy, if it's intentional, if that makes it any difference in the court of law.
I mean, the problem, like I said to you, the case that is always woven to the legislators by K Street is this is going to hurt the employees of the company. They always can suggest that damage to General Motors is not damage to the stockholders of General Motors, it's damage to the workers at General Motors. And the railroad, you're going to just hurt the railroad workers.
Who are the constituents of the elected officials.
Yeah, they're the constituents. But, you know, the whole thing is just a woven argument. And actually, you know, the proper application of regulations to everyone creates a level playing field for everyone. Maybe American industry is to some extent put at a disadvantage to a country's manufacturing where there is no regulation. But incidentally, one of the things we tout about America is we don't have smog like Beijing has. We spend a lot of time attacking China for the problems they have in their environment, which we don't have only because we enacted regulatory laws. I can remember the days when L.A. had smog every day, every day.
And those laws were changed not because the companies were so community-minded. They were forced. Well, in many instances.
Yeah, I think they were changed at a time when the American economy was the deal, and the paper industry and people like that didn't fight. They realized at some point they opened their eyes and looked at the rivers and said, yeah, I guess we got to do something about this. But, yeah, the fact is that it only changed because of regulation.
You know, Sandy, I don't know where the time went, but it's gone. And, conversation.
Yeah, we start out wondering what we're going to talk about, and then we wonder at the end, why was there so little time?
Yeah, well, thank you as always. What are we doing, turning the clocks back or up? I always get mixed up. Spring forward, all right. So we get 1 hour less sleep.
Yep.
Bah, humbug. I'll be back on Monday. Sandy and I will be back on Monday. Thank you again, Calvin, for a great week. All of you, be safe. I'll be back. We'll be back on Monday. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.